This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, this is Christine, and I'll be reading articles from the Epoch Times, April 17th through 23rd edition. The first headline is the FBI opens probe of Baltimore bridge collapse by Chase Smith. The FBI has opened an investigation into the March 26 collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore after the container ship Dolly struck a support tower. Quote, the FBI is present aboard the cargo ship Dolly, conducting court-authorized law enforcement activity, a spokesperson for the FBI's Baltimore field office told the Epoch Times in an email. Quote, there is no other public information available, and we will have no further comment. End quote. The FBI's statement and other media reports indicate that the agency is investigating the incident as a criminal matter. It is reportedly looking into whether the crew was aware of major issues with the vessel before it left the port, according to the Washington Post. Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott announced on April 15th that the city is taking legal steps to proactively and aggressively address the catastrophic impact that the bridge collapse has had on the city, its residents, families of victims, business owners, longshoremen, and other Port of Baltimore workers. This includes partnering with legal firms to hold accountable entities such as the owner, charterer, manager, operator, and the manufacturer of the dolly, as well as any other potentially liable third parties. The National Transportation Safety Board also has an open investigation into the incident. Information from the agency so far confirms that the nearly 1,000-foot-long Singapore-flagged vessel lost power before striking the bridge, leading to its collapse and damage to the vessel. Portions of the bridge are still being removed from the river as crews work to reopen the major shipping channel. The NTSB stated that no pollution has been reported, although several of the containers on the ship were carrying hazardous material. The agency, which is leading the investigation, classified the accident as a major marine casualty. NTSB Chair Jennifer Homendy said at a Senate hearing on April 10 that the agency had interviewed key personnel from the dolly, including pilots and the second officer, who was the man on watch at the time of the crash. Ms. Homendy told senators that she believes that the lights going out on the vessel prior to the collision, as shown in video footage of the accident, was related to whatever caused the power failure. She said investigators brought in Hyundai, the manufacturer of equipment in the engine room, to help determine the cause of the electrical issues by downloading data from the electrical power system and looking at the circuit breakers. Quote, a voyage data recorder provides very basic information, not like a flight data recorder. So there isn't enough information on that to understand, Ms. Homendy said. So that information in the engine room will help us tremendously. The preliminary report of the incident is expected the first week of May, she said. End of article. The next article is U.S. border outranks Ukraine in swing states, according to a poll. This article is written by Nathan Worcester. An April survey of swing or moderate voters in six battleground states suggests that the impact of an open southern border is concerning them more than events in Ukraine. Commissioned by the Heritage Foundation and executed by the nonpartisan RMG Research Incorporated, the poll revealed that 56% of those voters thought that the $113 billion price tag for Ukraine support thus far was either too much or far too much. Just 14% of those voters thought that the United States had not spent enough on military aid for Ukraine, while 16% rated the spending as about right. When asked to compare the importance of U.S. border security with that of Ukraine funding, 50% rated the border higher, 11% chose Ukraine, and 29% said both were equally important. Quote, Heritage's latest poll reveals that not only are moderate voters in battleground states more interested in securing our own borders, they believe we have already spent enough helping Ukraine, and rightfully so. Kevin Roberts, president of the Heritage Foundation, said in a statement, RMG interviewed 1,000 swing voters in Nevada, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Wisconsin, and Michigan between April 2nd and April 4th. Of the voters surveyed, the majority, 54%, were independent, 25% were Republicans, and 20% were Democrats. Quote, swing voters were defined as likely voters who are either undecided on the presidential election, undecided on the generic congressional ballot, or expressed a different partisan preference on the presidential and congressional races, a statement accompanying the survey reads. Of the voters RMG surveyed, 22% reported following news from the U.S. southern border very closely, while just 10% described a similar level of attention to news about the Ukraine-Russia war. The polling results were published amid a fight in the legislative branch over further military aid to Ukraine. Republicans and conservatives have argued that additional funding for the country must be conditioned on additional border security spending. A bipartisan group of lawmakers is pushing House Speaker Mike Johnson to advance a $95 billion aid package to Ukraine and Israel, citing Iran's attack on Israel in their April 14th letter to the lawmaker. But some House Republicans have objected to the lack of border-related funding in that package, as well as the linkage of funding for Israel and Ukraine in the same bill. Quote, it's anti-Semitic to make Israel aid contingent on funding Ukrainian Nazis. This should be separate bills, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene wrote on X on April 14th. Quote, the best way to help Israel against Iran and to help Ukraine against Russia is for Mr. Johnson and the House to pass the bipartisan Senate-passed National Security Supplemental this week, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer wrote on X on April 14th. In a recent news conference with Mr. Johnson, former President Donald Trump suggested that Ukraine should be funded through a loan rather than aid. The White House has rejected any standalone bill to fund Israel. End of article. The next article is Supreme Court of the United States Justices seems skeptical of January 6 obstruction charge by Matthew Vadim. Conservative Supreme Court justices seemed generally sympathetic on April 16 to a former police officer charged under an accounting reform law after he entered the U.S. Capitol for 4 minutes on January 6, 2021. The case is being closely watched because once the Supreme Court rules, its decision could affect hundreds of January 6 prosecutions, including the January 6 related case against former President Donald Trump. Joseph Fisher from Jonestown, Pennsylvania, which was indicted on several counts following the Capitol breach on January 6, including obstructing an official proceeding under Enron-era Obstruction Law 18 U.S. Code Section 1512. Convictions under the section can lead to 20 years in prison. The wording of 1512 is focused on documentation and ensured that it is made available for official proceedings. Section 1512 states, whoever corruptly alters, destroys, mutilates, or conceals a record, document, or other object, or attempts to do so with the intent to impair the object's integrity or availability for use in an official proceeding, or otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding, or attempts to do so, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years or both. End quote. The charge relates to the alleged obstruction of the congressional certification of the 2020 presidential election results, a proceeding that paved the way for the inauguration of President Joe Biden 2 weeks later. Mr. Fisher argues that he should not have been charged under Section 1512, an evidence tampering provision of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act aimed at curbing wrongdoing on Wall Street. Some defendants who arrived at the Capitol after Congress was evacuated were also charged with obstructing an official proceeding. Several defendants have argued unsuccessfully at trial that they couldn't have obstructed Congress because they weren't present in the Capitol until after lawmakers left the complex. Mr. Fisher also says he left the complex before Congress attempted to move forward with certifying the election and was in Maryland at the time of the security breach. Lawyers argue that the accounting reform law under which Mr. Fisher and others have been charged is being used by the Department of Justice to prosecute people who were exercising their First Amendment right to protest the congressional certification of election results. During oral arguments on April 16, Mr. Fisher's attorney, Jeffrey Green, said the Biden administration was wrong to charge his client under 1512, which was intended to be used for evidence tampering only. Congress passed the statute to prevent the destruction of evidence, he said. Until the January 6 prosecutions, 1512 had never been used for anything other than evidence tampering, Mr. Green said. U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Perlogar said, 1512 is not a narrow legal provision. Justice Neil Gorsuch asked if pulling a fire alarm to halt a proceeding would subject the offender to a 20-year prison term. Ms. Perlogar said it might be, but that the government would have to have proof of criminal intent. Justice Samuel Alito asked whether protesters blocking roads and bridges around the nation's capital, as happened on April 15, when pro-Palestinian protesters shut down the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, would violate the statute. Ms. Perlogar said she did not believe that would violate the statute. She also said Mr. Fisher went to the Capitol intending to prevent Congress from conducting business. At the Capitol, he allegedly assaulted a law enforcement officer, and that action impeded the ability of police to regain control and let Congress do its job, Ms. Perlogar said. In a recent brief, Mr. Fisher's attorneys denied that he committed acts of violence on January 6, 2021, and said he was instead a victim of violence. They said that he was knocked to the ground by a crowd surge, and that contrary to government claims that he was forcibly removed from the complex, he walked out on his own. Justice Amy Coney Barrett asked if the protesters could have been charged under the section even if they had not breached the Capitol. Ms. Perlogar said if that had happened when Congress had to go into recess from a joint session because of a security risk, then it, quote, probably would be chargeable if there was evidence of criminal intent. End of article. The next headline is Why U.S. Debt is Unsustainable and Destroying the Middle Class by Daniel LaCalle. In a recent social media post, a talented financial analyst and investor said, the debt is unsustainable narrative has been around for 40 years plus. What's astonishing to me is how the people who push this narrative never ask themselves, why has it been sustainable for so long? There is a widespread idea that the fiscal imbalances of a world reserve currency issuer would end in an Argentina-style bankruptcy. However, the manifestation of unsustainability did not even appear as drastic in Argentina itself. Hey, Argentina continues to exist, doesn't it? Excessive public debt is unsustainable when it becomes a burden on productive growth and leads the economy to constantly rising taxes, weaker productivity growth, and weaker real wage growth. However, the level of unsustainable accumulation of debt may continue to rise because the state itself imposes public debt on banks' balance sheets, and the state forces the financial sector to take all its debt as the lowest risk asset. However, all of this is simply a forced construct imposed by law and regulation. Rising debt bloats the government size in the economy and erodes its growth and productivity potential. Many diabetic and obese people continue to eat too much unhealthy food, thinking nothing has happened so far. That does not mean their eating habits are not unsustainable. Those who ignore the accumulation of public debt tend to do so under the idea that nothing has happened yet. This is a reckless way of looking at the economy, a sort of we have not killed ourselves yet, let us accelerate mentality. An ever weaker private sector, weak real wages, declining productivity growth, and the currency's diminishing purchasing power all indicate the unsustainability of debt levels. It becomes increasingly difficult for families and small businesses to make ends meet and pay for essential goods and services, while those who already have access to debt and the public sector smile in contentment. Why? Because the accumulation of public debt is printing money artificially. When money is created in the private sector through the financial system, there is a process of wealth creation and productive money creation. The financial system creates money for projects that yield a genuine economic return. Some fail, others soar. That is the process of productive economic growth and progress. Only when the central bank manipulates interest rates, disguises the cost of risk, and increases the money supply to monetize unproductive deficit spending can it distort this process. Private banks in an open economy create money to accelerate progress, and free-floating interest rates limit the accumulation of unproductive and dangerous risk. When the central bank wants to disguise the worsening solvency of fiscally imprudent governments, it does so by tampering with interest rates, making fiscally irresponsible governments borrowing cheaper and artificially increasing the amount of currency in the system, monetizing public debt, a destructive process of money creation as opposed to the saving investment function of banking. When the fiscal position is unsustainable, the only way for the state to force the acceptance of its debt, newly created currency, is through coercion and repression. A state's debt is only an asset when the private sector values its solvency and uses it as a reserve. When the state imposes its insolvency on the economy, its bankruptcy manifests in the destruction of the purchasing power of the currency through inflation and the weakening of real wage purchasing capacity. The state basically conducts a process of slow default on the economy through rising taxes and weakening the purchasing power of the currency, which leads to weaker growth and the erosion of the middle class, the captive hostages of the currency issuer. Of course, as the currency issuer, the state never acknowledges its imbalances and always blames inflation and weak growth on the private sector, exporters, other nations, and markets. Independent institutions must impose fiscal prudence to prevent a state from destroying the real economy. The state, through the monopoly of currency issuance and the imposition of law and regulation, will always pass on its imbalances to consumers and businesses, thinking that it is for their own good. The government deficit is not a savings for the private economy. Savings in the real economy accept public debt as an asset when they perceive the currency issuer's solvency to be reliable. When the government imposes it and disregards the functioning of the productive economy, positioning itself as the source of wealth, it undermines the very foundation it purports to protect, the standard of living for the average citizen. Governments do not create reserves. Their debt becomes a reserve only when the productive private sector economy within their political boundaries thrives and the public finances remain under control. The state does not show its insolvency like any issuer in the price of the IOU it distributes, i.e., in the purchasing power of the currency. Public debt is artificial currency creation, because the state does not create anything. It only administers the money it collects from the same productive private sector it is choking with taxes and inflation. The U.S. debt started to become unsustainable when the Federal Reserve stopped defending the currency and paying attention to monetary aggregates to implement policies designed to disguise the rising cost of indebtedness from unbridled deficit spending. Artificial currency creation is never neutral. It disproportionately benefits the first recipient of the new currency, the government, and massively hurts the last recipients, real wage earners and people with deposit savings. It is a massive transfer of wealth from the productive economy and savers to the bureaucratic administration. More units of public debt mean weaker productive growth, higher taxes, and more inflation in the future. All three are manifestations of a slow burn default. So, if the state can impose its fiscal imbalances on us, how do we know if the debt it issues is unsustainable? First, because of the units of gross domestic product created, adding new units of public debt diminishes rapidly. Second, the erosion of the currency purchasing power persists and accelerates. Third, because productive investment and capital expenditures decline, employment may remain acceptable in the headlines, but real wages, productivity, and the ability of workers to make ends meet deteriorate rapidly. Today's narrative tries to tell us that nothing has happened when a lot has. There is a destruction of the middle class, and it continues to deteriorate. End of article and end of my reading. This has been Christine reading from the Epoch Times, and I hope you have a wonderful day.